Hi, and welcome to DC Public Safety. I'm Len Sipes. Today at our microphone is Scott H. Shortenhouse, and he is the Deputy Director, Center for Faith-Based and Community Initiatives from the U.S. Department of Labor. One of the things that the U.S. Department of Labor has is a program experience of 6 years running reentry programs. They have, I think, some fairly interesting results from the standpoint of faith-based institutions cooperating and basically running reentry programs, offender reentry programs. And they also have some experience in terms of, needless to say, they're the U.S. Department of Labor, of putting offenders into jobs. And with that introduction, Scott, hi. Welcome to DC Public Safety.
Len, it's great to be with you.
Okay, now tell me a little bit about your program.
Sure.
Give us some background.
Sure. The U.S. Department of Labor Center for Faith-Based and Community Initiatives has really been operating in the reentry space, as you mentioned, for about 6 years now. Through a couple programs. One is the Ready for Work program, and then one is the President's Reentry Initiative. The Ready for Work program is completed. We've got some great statistics on that, and that's kind of given way to the President's Reentry Initiative, which we are operating in now.
Now, the bottom line is that the U.S. Department of Labor, now you've been in partnership with other federal organizations on this?
Yes. In the President's Reentry Initiative, it was developed from a coalition that included the Department of Justice, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, the Department of Health and Human Services.
Mm-hmm.
And so we really have kind of brought together a broad federal coalition because, as you know, reentry touches all of the different, many different issue areas that are handled by these different federal agencies.
Okay, so all these federal agencies got together in essence, and I think the Department of Labor pretty much took the lead on this.
Yes.
Okay, so the various federal agencies got together and decided what to do, faith-based reentry.
Yep. What we did from this coalition, what we developed is the current program, which is the Department of Labor has granted 30 grants to faith-based and community organizations all across the country. And these are, as I mentioned, some are faith-based, some are community-based, but they are organizations that are all across the country that are providing workforce development services, job training, job placement, job retention. They're providing case management. They're providing mentoring.
Okay, so these are basically community organizations that are doing this. So we're not talking about the mayor's office. We're not talking about the city of Baltimore. We're not talking about specific programs.
No.
Government programs, government entities. We're talking about community-based organizations doing these initiatives, 30 of them throughout the country.
That's correct.
Okay, why community-based organizations?
Well, we have found that all of these community-based organizations, and not just the 30, but community-based organizations all across the country are really trusted presences within their communities. I've been talking to different pastors, and they would even say in front of their congregations, how many of you have been touched by somebody that either in your family or maybe your friends that are reentering from society? And many people raise up within these organizations. They are trusted presences within the community. They have a compassionate vision. They provide holistic services. And I think one of the most important points is this, that As we all know in prisoner reentry, these men and women that are returning have a myriad of needs, from mm-hmm. housing to substance
yes.
abuse to perhaps a job readiness, to family reunification, and there are no one organization can go it alone. So this, we're looking at building broad coalitions within these communities.
Okay. In essence, that's the state of the art of the research in terms of building these coalitions. But let me ask, quite frankly, there's a lot of community-based organizations, there have been a lot of faith-based organizations that do not have the administrative structure to pull
right.
off programs.
Right.
Now, that has been a problem mm-hmm. in some of the organizations that I've dealt with directly. I'm not saying that they shouldn't be involved. They mm-hmm. have to be involved.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying they should be part of the leadership. They have to take leadership. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they lack the administrative structure in many cases just to handle the money.
Sure. Len, there's no doubt that there are challenges in working with these organizations. No organization is perfect, and we all know that sometimes faith-based or community organizations have challenges within their capacity operating a grant or administering resources, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the important point is here, we should not exclude them from partnership, but rather welcome them into these partnerships so that, we can help them build their capacity so that they can serve these men and women more effectively and more efficiently.
All right, that's a good point. Now, the other point we have to get onto before discussing the larger program is this issue of faith-based. There is controversy. I mean, we have, at the Court Services and Offender Supervision Agency, we have a large faith-based coalition. We believe strongly, for exactly the reasons that you articulated, that it is the faith community that is going to take the lead on this issue. And we believe strongly that they have the cachet within the community, that they have the support of the community, and that if Minister X or Imam X gets up, or Rabbi X gets up and says, you know what, this is vital for our community, this is something that we should be doing, they do it. But critics justifiably come along and suggest, well, you know, wait a minute, you know, this is the United States government. Should we really be investing in faith-related issues? I thought that there was a separation between church and state. Please deal with that.
Yeah, and Len, it's a good point and well taken, and that is that within all of the Department of Labor grants, there are firewalls put in so that we make sure that, to the best of our abilities, that we are making sure that these organizations are not proselytizing or on the federal dime or are abusing federal resources for those means.
Right.
But I think the more important point here is that many of these organizations can provide fantastic results in getting these men and women back into society and helping them stay out of prison. So making sure that we are putting these firewalls and these safeties in so that we're not abusing federal dollars, but also it just is good public policy to bring them into partnerships and not exclude them because they have a religious charter or a mission.
Well, they have the leadership role, and criminologists have been saying for the last 40 years that the community must be heavily involved in any of these endeavors. The community needs to take a leadership role in any of these endeavors. So what is, in many of our communities throughout the country, what is more of substance, I suppose, than the church or the synagogue or the mosque. But in essence, these individuals, if they go to a Baptist church, if they go to a Catholic church, if they go to an Islamic center, if they go to a synagogue, they're not asked to convert. They're not asked to partake in their religious endeavors. They may be invited to come to church, but nobody is saying that if it's an Islamic-based program or a Catholic or a Baptist-based program that you in any way, shape, or form need to embrace the tenets of that religion, correct?
Good point. That is correct, Len. Two points here. One is that these, if an organization is faith-based, they cannot discriminate based on religion on those that come in. So
right.
Anybody is welcome to be served under these programs.
Okay.
And second is that, as you mentioned, any inherently religious activities are taking place in a different time and a different location from the grants that they serve. So let's say these organizations, which are providing job training programs, they have a set time and location for the federal grant to teach people how to get jobs in the community. And if they want to, for instance, have any sort of like a Bible study or a worship or a prayer or anything like that, what we have said is that has to be at a separate time and location, and you cannot coerce anybody within this grant program mm-hmm. to participate in that as a condition of participating in the program.
Right. Okay. Well, we've put that to bed, but there are still going to be our critics who will say, well, it's almost impossible to keep individuals, it's almost impossible to separate the two. But yet the churches that I've dealt with and the mosques that I dealt with insist that they hold to those tenets. They insist that they will not do anything at all in terms of trying to convince anybody that particular religion is what they should be embracing. They said that they live by example, and if others want to follow that example, that's fine. But it's never from the standpoint of, listen, you have to come to church if you're going to be part of this program. That's not there. So hopefully we've put that to bed, but noting full well that critics of that concept are going to remain, and that's that. Okay, so what we have, again, is this broad-based coalition of the Department of Labor, Department of Justice, and other federal organizations. You have, for the past 6 years, done these grants to 30 community-based organizations, faith-based organizations throughout the country. And in essence, you've done two things, as I understand it, two main things. One is mentoring, providing individuals from the community to help them, specifically, not necessarily coming out of prison, but it could include people on probation, which is they don't go to prison. They are sentenced to being supervised in the community. But principally, people coming out of the prison system, these programs will assign mentors, community volunteers who are trained to help that person readjust after the correctional experience. And the second thing that you guys have done is basically to provide jobs and to assessment, figuring out what that person is capable of doing, training that person if necessary, and placing that person in a job. Do I have the two basic tenets down correctly?
That's correct, Len. Yes.
Okay. So what do you think is the primary variable, Scott, in terms of the effectiveness of the programs? Is it mentoring? Is it getting a job? Or is it both? Or is it other undefined features?
Well, in our programs, Len, as you mentioned, those are the two focuses of our program. And they both really interact together. I wouldn't say it's mentoring over job placement and training. I wouldn't say it's job placement and training over mentoring. They really work together in the programs themselves.
But sometimes, the difficulty that we within the criminal justice system have is being specific when we talk to reporters, when we talk to policymakers, when we talk to politicians, because they're interested in, okay, Leonard, what works? Tell me what works. And it's almost impossible to tell you specifically what works, because for this particular person, it could be drug treatment. In this particular person, it could be mental health treatment. Mm-hmm. For this particular person, finding a job.
Right.
And a job with a future. For another person, it could be that she desperately needs somebody to talk to and guide them mm-hmm. as to the basics of life. Mm-hmm. So that's the frustration for those of us in the criminal justice system to
sure.
be able to provide that specific sense of what works strategically, empirically. Quite frankly, we can't do that.
Right.
But obviously, 80% of the individuals have histories of substance abuse. Obviously, most of them, the vast majority of them, do not have clear-cut job histories. Mm-hmm. Most of them dropped out of school. Mm-hmm. Most of them have had histories of problems at home, mm-hmm. Ranging anywhere to the almost scandalous degree of sexual victimization on the part of female offenders. Mm-hmm. So we have a fairly complicated individual to deal with when they come out of the prison system.
Right. Right. And that's a good question, Lennon. And I actually would like to just talk a little bit about some results that we've seen from our program.
Yeah, please.
Because that'll
please.
Kind of help frame this conversation,
please.
I think. I'd like to start, as I mentioned, with a program called Ready for Work. And
okay.
Ready for Work was our real pilot program, and mm-hmm. it concluded in August of 2006. And, mm-hmm. and here are just some results from that program.
Okay.
We served about 4,500 participants in
okay.
this, and these are adults, ages 18 to 35.
Right.
And what we've seen is this. Through the program, 57% of the adults were placed into jobs.
Okay.
And of those that were placed, 63% retained these jobs for 3 consecutive months after placement.
Okay, and I can tell you just from the research that those results are outstanding.
And we tend to agree. And let's look at mentoring real quick, just for the sake of this conversation. In mentoring, 63% of the participants, 63% of participants that went through the program received mentoring services. And
mm-hmm.
let me just define mentoring real quick.
Please.
Mentoring, for the purposes of our programs, is a relationship, essentially, between a volunteer mentor from the community
mm-hmm.
and a participant
mm-hmm.
that helps them navigate their return to society.
Right.
It is, we look for to develop these relationships. It could be one-on-one. It could be group mentoring.
Right.
But we're encouraging relationships between folks on the outside, typically not a boss or not a case manager, but somebody where they could talk with, somebody
right.
outside of the program where they can say, I'm having a hard time with this coworker. I'm having a hard time navigating the local transit system. I'm having a real hard time with the mother of my child, and sometimes when you get really frustrated, just to have somebody to go to, who they can talk with, who can help them, as I said, navigate their transition back into society. And so what we've done is we've sliced the data in Ready for Work, and for of those 63% that were in mentoring
mm-hmm.
versus the I guess that would be 37% that were not did
mm-hmm.
not receive mentoring services, and this is what we found. Mentored participants remained in the program longer than unmentored services by
mm-hmm.
an average of about 3 months. So it helps
okay.
in program retention. Mentored participants were twice as likely to obtain a job.
Say that again. Those people mentored were twice as likely to find a job.
Twice as likely to find a job. That's right. And meeting with a mentor increased a participant's odds of getting a job the next month by 73% over those that did not receive mentoring services. Mm-hmm. And also, those who met with a mentor were 56% more likely to remain employed for 3 consecutive months than of those that did not were not matched with a mentor.
So that combination of mentoring and jobs.
Mentoring and jobs.
Is a very potent combination.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's why they don't operate in silos, we believe. Because obviously the main motivation for them coming to our programs is they need a job. They need employment.
Well, you hear that from everybody. When they come out into the street, we're offering a variety of things in this agency, anywhere from mental health assistance to drug treatment to doing educational assessments, job training, mentoring, mm-hmm. Faith-based mentoring. And the guy looks at you and goes, look, Mr. Sipes, I need a job.
Yes, absolutely.
Need a job.
That is
all that other stuff can come afterwards. I need a job. And I need a job. I don't need to go to McDonald's. I need a job. I need a real job mm-hmm. that I can have a future with.
Absolutely. That is the driving motivation for many of these, I'd say most of these participants that come to our programs. What we're saying is mentoring helps that. Mentoring helps with, like I said, program retention. Mm-hmm. Mentoring helps with job placement. And mentoring helps with job retention. So matching the two is a really important thing that I would like, that our programs have shown.
Now, think about this for a second. In terms of the people in our audience, that if you had an individual, a trusted individual, smart individual, caring individual, generally speaking, older than you, who's been around the block once or twice, and if that person was there and you could call that person and you could meet with that person and basically say, you know what, the guy at my supervisor at my job is a real pain in the butt, and I'm really to let him have it verbally. This guy is just on my derriere constantly. I'm getting sick of it. I'm thinking about quitting this job. To have somebody to go to who helps you through that process, that helps you deal responsibly with that process, I think is a godsend. I think we could all use a mentor
absolutely.
In our lives.
Absolutely.
And that becomes a crucial issue here.
Absolutely. And we've heard time and time again through different stories through the program that repeated over and over again. And I think it's important to realize where these men and women, when they come back, what support systems are they coming back to? They often will return to the same communities where they probably committed their crimes.
Same problems,
same friends. Maybe their family has dropped them. And they don't have the support network, the support system in place, which is really what the mentors are trying to address there, is to give them some sort of support that maybe many of us that have not been in that situation might take for granted.
Some people have compared it, and I'm probably stepping on some toes when I suggest this. Some people have compared it to an alternative gang, that many of these individuals come from gang structures and they come out of the prison system, and boy, when we talk about group mentoring, by the way. So they got the 30 people in their gang that hung out on the street corner, and suddenly they've got the 30 people in that gang who's hanging out at the Baptist church or the mosque or the synagogue. So they have this larger structure they can go to, and if that mentor doesn't have a solution, he or she can turn to the larger congregation and say, this guy is going for a job interview this Monday, and he just doesn't have the clothing for the job interview. Here's a size. Does anybody have a spare suit, or does anybody know of a clothing ministry? So there's a network.
Absolutely.
So that suddenly becomes the gang support that he had before going to prison suddenly becomes an alternative gang. Only in these cases, it's a faith-based gang. But that's the structure that they come from, isn't
sure.
it? They join the gangs because of the sense of acceptance, that sense of support, that sense of solidarity.
Absolutely.
Only in this case, it is a faith-based group that provides them that, with that sense of solidarity, that sense of support, that sense of networking, correct?
Absolutely, absolutely. And if these faith-based or community organizations aren't there to aid in this process, they're just going to go right back to what they knew. And you're exactly right, Lynn. I mean, it's providing the positive support so that they do not relapse into some of their negative cycles that they had established.
So many offenders have told me after the prison experience that they need a bridge.
Mm-hmm.
They need to cross a bridge because they come home, mm-hmm. and in some cases, the family doesn't want them. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, the family does not want them mm-hmm. in the house. Or, the cousin will let them stay, but only long enough to get a job and move out on his own.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tough living arrangement, and in many cases they come out to, hey, I have to navigate the subway system. I don't know how to do that.
Yeah.
What are cell phones?
Absolutely.
And how do you operate a cell phone? I'm going for the job interview. What should I say about my prior prison experience? And this gives them that support mechanism. The other thing I wanted to ask you about, though, is that mentoring to these individuals is not easy.
Right. That's true.
And that's the bottom line in terms of the difficulties of having community volunteers do this.
That's right.
Because, as one person said to me one time, said, I'll read to the kids in the elementary school. I'll bring meals to the elderly. But, I tried mentoring to offenders, and
right.
boy, they're, Yeah, I can get a lot of appreciation, a lot of love
Absolutely.
From the kids at the elementary school. I get smiles from the elderly when I deliver them their meals. These guys don't bring a lot of smiles to the table, and thereby a lot of individuals start off with the best of intentions and drop out of the process because of the process of mentoring offenders, considering everything that they bring to the table is not the easiest of assignments.
Absolutely. And Len, one of the things that we've done at the Department of Labor is create resources for organizations that are interested in starting a mentoring program. One that we just released here is called Mentoring Ex-Prisoners, a guide for prisoner reentry programs.
And I've read it, and it's wonderful. And by the way, I have to give out the telephone number of people to get in touch with you. Scott Shortenhouse is a deputy director of the Center for Faith-Based and Community Initiatives from the U.S. Department of Labor. His telephone number is 202-693-6459. Again, 202-693-6459. And I'll repeat that at the end of the program. Go ahead, Scott.
Yeah, sure. And I just want to touch on this, on mentoring, just for a couple minutes, because it's very, very important as you develop a mentoring program that you think this out, that you think it through what mentoring is and what mentoring is not, so that when you start to recruit your mentors, you're not selling them. It's like you mentioned, it can be hard work.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, we are in the business in mentoring of developing relationships, and mm-hmm. relationships take time. They take commitment. And sometimes people in the congregation might want to give an hour a month or an hour every 3 months,
right.
and that's just not going to cut it. And so you really have to define for the people in the community, the people in the wherever you're pulling your mentors from, what mentoring is and what mentoring isn't.
We've all mentored in one way, shape, or form, whether it's a cousin, whether it's a son, whether it's a daughter, whether it is a family friend. We've all mentored that individual
sure.
through a variety of different problems in their lives, and
sure.
it can be intense.
It can be. It can be. It takes time, and I've heard a lot of mentors that have said, sometimes on Tuesday night I get a call at 3 a.m, 2 mm-hmm. in the morning. Some issues are going on, some things that need immediate attention. Where when you're in a relationship with somebody that's trying to transition back, these things happen, and
sure.
you have to be willing to devote time and energy to this. It's also very, very important to develop a mentor curriculum and to also set out what your responsibilities are, what your commitments are going to be from these mentors. How many is it going to be group? Is it going to be one-on-one? What types of activities are you looking for?
Mm-hmm.
Do you provide some nights where maybe you'll get together and you'll talk about financial literacy? Maybe you go to a ball game. Maybe you do other things where you're developing relationships.
And maybe you're just talk.
Maybe you're just talking. And at the end of the day, you have to prevent mentor burnout. And it's it's important that you you handle your mentors well, so that, you know, it's a wonderful mm-hmm. resource if somebody's willing to get into these relationships. Mm-hmm. But you just have to provide a lot of supervision and support to these mentors, so that they are that it's a good experience for the participant and for the mentor, and that this relationship just continues to continue on.
I'll give you another example. Yeah. We had a women's program, women offender program, mm-hmm. and because there are dramatically different issues facing women offenders than male offenders. The women offenders generally have higher rates of substance abuse, mental health problems. They have kids. Mm-hmm. Most of them are mothers. 80% of them are mothers. And they come out of the prison system. Well, oftentimes the males, the kids are, you know, entities floating around out there to the woman. They're children who need to be raised. Mm-hmm. And so one woman got up at one of these seminars and basically said that I moved in with a friend of mine and my two kids, and she threatened me. She pulled a knife on me, threatened my kids. I broke a bottle, and we were standing off, and I finally had to get out of this house. Now I'm homeless with two kids. What are you all going to do about that? And it's like, wow, that's a real life issue. I mean, people say, well, what are your community supervision officers, as we call them in Washington, D.C.? They're called parole and probation officers throughout the country. What do they do? Well, that parole and probation officer, that community supervision officer, could spend the next day trying to find emergency shelter for this woman and her two children, mm-hmm. and at the same time, try to find long-range housing. So these volunteers, these mentors, have got to deal with that, but at the same time to learn how to use the existing system so the burden doesn't fall entirely on their shoulders. It's up to us to be the primary helpers of this individual, but, you know, she can certainly encourage, talk to them, shepherd her through the system.
Absolutely. And Len, you brought up a really good point that I'd like to echo, and that is that oftentimes these organizations and these mentors can be really a parole officer's best friend or a community supervisor's officer's best friend, mm-hmm. and when they work in tandem. And we've seen that all over the country where oftentimes the parole and probation of folks know exactly where these organizations are and what resources they provide,
right.
and they can help ease the burden of their workload as well.
Right, and so when we're talking about mentorship, I don't want to give people the impression that this is all their problem. We're not saying that at all, that this is it's our problem. Those of us who are paid to deal with offenders, mm-hmm. it's our issue, not theirs, but certainly the mentor calling up the parole and probation officer and saying, look, I have a real problem. We got to work on this now. What can you do for this individual? To advocate mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. for that person, to be sure that the ball is not dropped, to be sure that right. the case doesn't fall through the cracks. I think that's their job, to mm-hmm. make sure that they advocate for the interest of that individual offender. But the rest of us yep. who are paid to do this, we're yep. the ones who are responsible for fixing it.
Right. Well, I think it's a real team effort. I mean, I think we're all working towards the same goal, and nobody wants to see that offender return to prison or a life of reincarceration. So I think it's great to work together.
Scott, we've got a couple minutes left in this program. We're going to have you back because we haven't even begun to tap all of the issues in this discussion. I want to give out Scott's telephone number one more time. It's Scott Shortenhouse. He's the Deputy Director, Center for Faith-Based and Community Initiatives for the U.S. Department of Labor, working in cooperation with other federal agencies, the Department of Justice, and others. His telephone number is 202, and I'm having a hard time seeing this, 693-6459, 202-693-6459, Scott.
And Len, can I also just add that all of our resources are available on our website?
So yeah, please, on the website.
The website is dol.gov.
Dol.gov.
Slash.
C-F-B-C-I.
And I'll give that out again. www.dol.gov/C for Center. F for faith, B for based, C for community, I for initiatives.
Okay.
And there's a prisoner reentry link on the right-hand side of our website, and all of our resources are listed. We've got a prisoner reentry toolkit for faith-based and community organizations
it's
that are interested
toolkit.
In developing resource and a reentry program, and a lot of other ways that you can find out about the federal bonding program, work opportunity tax credit, the weed and seed program operated by Department of Justice, et cetera.
So. Ladies and gentlemen, again at our microphones today was Scott Shortenhouse, the Deputy Director of Center for Faith-Based and Community Programs. My name is Len Sipes. This is DC Public Safety. I want everybody to have yourselves a very pleasant day.